Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Mullen with the Glover Park Group. I wanted to thank you all for joining us on the call this morning. I will turn the call over to Lester Brown shortly, but wanted to let you all know that a copy of Lester's remarks and the corresponding data sets that he will talk about today are already posted on the Earth Policy Institute website. The web address for that website is www.earth-policy.org. We will also be live tweeting today's teleconference from the EPI, the Earth Policy Institute Twitter handle, with the hashtag EPITelcon. It's EPITelcon. And lastly, a recording of today's call will also be available on the same website, the EPI website, later today, so you can go back and listen to today's call if you miss anything. And now I'll turn over the call to Lester Brown, who is an author and current president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book, World on the Edge, provides a roadmap for how to prevent an environmental and economic collapse. And that book is also available on the EPI website. And now I'll turn the call over to Lester.
Thank you, Jen. In thinking about the trend that we're looking at this morning, this reversal in carbon emissions, I've tried to think of a word to describe it, and historic is the only one that I can think of. After decades, generations actually, of rising carbon emissions, suddenly we're headed down, and it's not just a short-term blip. Between 2007 and 2011, U.S. coal use dropped by 10%. Oil use went down by 11%. Natural gas is up by 6%. The net effect of these trends is that U.S. carbon emissions have dropped 7% in the last 4 years. We are using data for 2011 that are actually Department of Energy estimates. They used the actual data for the first 8 months of this year and then made estimates for the four concluding months to come up with the estimates for 2011. It's been widely assumed that the decline in carbon emissions is the result of the economic downturn. And that was initially the case, but now there are new forces at work that are driving this decline in carbon emissions, forces that are surprisingly strong and that will be continuing for some time. With coal, we have a strong, well-organized anti-coal movement that's beginning to measurably reduce coal use in this country. In the early stages, it's centered on opposing new coal plants. And as a result of that, there are now very few plants under construction in this country. We have, in effect, a de facto moratorium on launching new coal plants. The Beyond Coal campaign, as it's called, is coordinated at the national level by the Sierra Club, but it involves a couple of dozen national environmental and health groups, along with hundreds of local groups. It's a well-organized, very strong campaign. The second phase of the campaign is to close existing coal plants. Of the 492 coal plants we have in the United States, 68 are now scheduled to close within the next few years. One of the closings is the Potomac River coal plant, which is just across the river, literally from Washington, D.C. It is scheduled to close by next October 1st. It's a 62-year-old plant. It's a 485-megawatt plant, which means it's a large coal plant, and it burns 280,000 tons of coal every year. So as a source of air pollution, it's a major one, but it will soon be gone, and we'll have some of the cleanest air in D.C. that we've had in generations. The goal of the Beyond Coal movement is to eventually close all the country's coal plants. And there are a number of reasons for this, environmental as well as health. Most people are not aware of it, but burning coal leads to 13,200 deaths each year. That 13,200 deaths exceeds all the U.S. combat fatalities in Afghanistan and Iran over the last 10 years. So it's not inconsequential. The healthcare costs of treating respiratory illnesses is huge. In August, the American Economic Review published the most comprehensive analysis yet of the indirect effects of burning coal in the United States. And their conclusion was a surprising one and a strong one. It basically writes the epitaph for the coal industry. It said that the damage, mostly from air pollution, from burning coal, exceeds the value of the electricity produced at coal-fired power plants. So this is not the cost of production. This is the indirect cost, the effect of air pollution on people, crops, etc. The indirect costs are a major factor in the future. This is one of the reasons why New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg donated $50 million to the Sierra Club for their Beyond Coal campaign to further expand it and strengthen it. Michael Bloomberg says, very simply, coal has to go. And he's not talking about closing a few plants. He's talking about closing all the coal plants in the country. This sounds difficult, but it may not be nearly as difficult as it first appears. The Department of Energy projections for residential electricity use per person for this decade indicate roughly a 5% decline. And that's a reversal of the historical trend where electricity use per person has been climbing for decades. One of the big factors that is going to reduce electricity use in the years immediately ahead is the requirement from the Energy Act of 2007 that we phase out incandescent light bulbs and replace them with compact fluorescents and LEDs. There are in this country something like 4 billion light sockets, and 3 billion of them still include the old, inefficient incandescents. On January 1st, 2 months from now, the 100-watt incandescent bulbs will disappear from shelves. On January 1st, 2014, 2 years from this January, all the 75-watt, 60-watt, and 40-watt incandescent bulbs will also disappear from shelves. They will be replaced by compact fluorescents and LEDs, which have the effect of increasing energy efficiency by about 80% over incandescents. In some situations, some distributors like IKEA, for example, have already taken incandescents off their shelves. California is a year ahead of Washington on this in banning the use of incandescents. We're also looking at some very substantial gains in household appliance efficiency. And this is because of legislation that's been passed in years past that's now translating into much more efficient dishwashers, air conditioners, TV sets, etc. So we're looking at a situation where residential electricity use is more likely going to be declining than rising, and certainly in per capita terms, it will be going down. The other thing that's making it easy to close coal-fired power plants is the shift to renewables, to wind and solar and geothermal. Over the last 4 years, some 400 wind farms have come online in the United States. They total 27,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That's enough to satisfy the needs of 8 million homes or about 14 million people. But beyond the 27,000 megawatts that have come online, there are now nearly 300,000 megawatts of wind-generating capacity in queue waiting access to transmission lines. So we have an enormous amount of wind, not only wind energy, but projects to tap wind resources to back out fossil fuels. The leader in wind electric generation is Texas, which is ironic because it's also still our leader in oil production. The other four states after Texas in wind electric generation are Iowa, California, Minnesota, and Illinois. In terms of the share of electricity coming from wind, Iowa is now the leader with 20% of the electricity consumed in the state coming from wind farms. Solar panels, though starting later than wind, are now beginning to expand very rapidly. At the beginning of this year, we had something like 2,500 megawatts of solar panels in operation, but this year we'll be adding nearly 2,000 megawatts, almost doubling what we've done in years past. Beyond this, there are now 22,000 megawatts of utility-scale solar developments in the pipeline. And these include installations that will generate 200, 300, 500 megawatts of electricity, most of them being built in California, Arizona, and Nevada. But we're looking at huge solar farm installations generating some of the largest ones. There may be one now coming with 1,000 megawatts. At peak power, it would generate as much electricity as a nuclear power plant. While coal use has been dropping, so has the use of oil. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, the national automobile fleet is no longer expanding. In fact, it's shrinking a bit. The fuel efficiency of cars is rising, and the miles driven per car is declining. These are three of the key trends that are leading to the decline in oil use. The number of licensed vehicles in the U.S. peaked a couple of years ago at 250 million. And since then, the number of cars scrapped has equaled or exceeded the number of new cars sold. So the fleet is beginning to shrink, and the peak at 250 million came just 2 or 3 years ago. There are a number of reasons why new car sales have dropped off and are not expected to regain the levels of that we saw in the late 1990s and the early years of this century. One is a changing attitude of young people toward automobiles. It's an attitude very different than that of earlier generations. In my generation, growing up in a rural community in southern New Jersey, getting a driver's license and a car or a pickup or something to drive was sort of a rite of passage. Every one of my classmates did exactly that. But today, young people growing up in cities and in an urban environment, and where socialization is not taking place with cars but with smartphones, and this is altering. It's reducing the number of teenagers who get driver's license, for example. Today, we have about 10 million licensed teenage drivers. In 1979, over 30 years ago, we had 12 million licensed teenage drivers. So we're looking at a changing automobile market with young people not being nearly as automobile-oriented as earlier generations. The second thing is the enormous increase in fuel efficiency. The current standards that have been developed this year by the Obama administration call for an increase in fuel efficiency by 2025 that would reduce by half the amount of gasoline used by cars sold in 2010, which was last year. So over the next 15 years, basically, we're looking at the fuel efficiency of new cars, the fuel efficiency increasing by half. People are also driving less, and that's partly because public transport has increased, because gasoline prices have been much higher in recent years, and because cities are concentrating, many of them, on developing a bicycle infrastructure with designated lanes for bicycles, bike paths, sidewalk parking racks, etc. Beyond creating the bicycle infrastructure, some cities are now turning to bike sharing programs, and these include Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, and a number of other cities. Another interesting demographic that is affecting gasoline use is the number of people entering the retirement age. Once people retire, they're no longer working and no longer commuting, their gasoline use drops by a third to a half. And what we are now looking at is a record number of people retiring. These are the baby boomers who were born beginning in 1945. A 1945 baby boomer is now 66 years old and has retired. So we're just beginning to see the effects of the largest age groups in U.S. history entering the retirement age and, as a result, substantially reducing their gasoline consumption. There's also another interesting linkage between coal use and oil use. As coal use declines, so does the use of oil. Coal is moved from the mines to the power plants by freight rail. roughly 40% of the diesel fuel used in the U.S. freight rail system is used to move coal. So as we move less and less coal from mines to power plants, the diesel fuel use in the freight sector declines. So declining coal use in this case leads to declining oil use. Another thing that's going to affect during this decade the amount of oil use, the amount of gasoline consumption, is the shift from gasoline to electricity. And that is just beginning. But during this decade, it's going to become a much more important force in reducing gasoline use. This year, we have seen the release of GM's Volt and Nissan's Leaf. The Volt is not classified as a hybrid, but it has both a gasoline engine and an electric motor, runs primarily on the electric motor, using the smaller gasoline engine to recharge the battery when needed. The Leaf, the car produced by Nissan, is an all-electric car. So we're now seeing the first of the all-electric or electric hybrids coming on the market. Prius will be coming on with a plug-in version in early next year. There are literally dozens of either all-electric or plug-in hybrid model cars being developed by all the major automobile manufacturers. And these will be coming on the market more and more with each year. The exciting thing is the prospect of being able to run our cars not only on electricity, but in many cases with wind-generated electricity. So the fuel for running our cars will be a carbon-free source. Michael McElroy, Professor Michael McElroy at Harvard, has calculated the wind electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline, and it costs about 80 cents. So there's going to be a strong economic attraction to shifting from gasoline to electricity, particularly if oil prices continue at a high level in the future or rise even higher. So what we're looking at is a very substantial decline in oil use in the years ahead, and that's in addition to the 11% decline we've seen in the last 4 years. One of the consequences of this substantial decline in gasoline use is to question whether we need the much-debated Keystone Pipeline to bring oil from tar sands in Canada to oil refineries in Texas. With our gasoline use dropping as much as it is, and indeed already has, there's a question of whether we need that pipeline. Most of the debate on the pipeline has, or as to whether it should be built, has been centered around the possibility of leakage of oil, particularly in the states that rely on the Ogallala Aquifer for water and possible contamination of the aquifer. And the second is the climate effect of, in effect, creating a much larger market for the energy inefficient oil that comes from the tar sands. It takes a lot of energy to get the oil out of the tar sands. It's a high carbon operation. But the question now is, do we actually need that pipeline? I think the answer is clearly no. In looking ahead, we're seeing, in addition to the 7% drop in carbon emissions over the last 4 years, we think that 7% could increase to 20% by 2020. That is, between 2007, when oil consumption peaked in the U.S., and 2020, we could see a 20% drop in oil use and carbon emissions from oil use. It could go even higher. I mean, conceivably, it could go as high as 30%. But the exciting thing is that carbon emissions, which were rising in the United States, the world's largest economy, are now declining and declining at a rapid, unanticipated rate, I should say. This means that the U.S. could, if this trend continues as we expect it to, could become something of a model for other countries. And it also means that the United States could again emerge as a leader in the effort to stabilize the Earth's climate. So this trend reversal replacing the rise in carbon emissions with a decline in carbon emissions is historic in an economic sense because it's going to lead to a transformation of the, particularly the U.S. energy economy, but it also is going to lower carbon emissions in the world's largest economy, which makes it much easier to think about stabilizing climate at the global level.
And moving on to Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock.
Lester, I'm wondering how much of the coal figures that you presented, actually the oil figures you presented, the reduction, are the result of two factors offshoring them, one being the offshoring of production to China. Their emissions are rising, and it's partly because everything is made there. And secondly, also, do these figures take into account the excess pollution from the Canadian tar sands, which even without this pipeline are powering a large part of the Midwest? So there's so much emissions in Canada that may not be showing up in the American figures.
Alex, those are both good points. Because we import so many manufactured goods from China, the carbon emissions that are associated with our consumption actually show up in China's carbon emission. That's not a debatable point. And it's true that the numbers I'm talking about do not include those. And it's also the case that the emissions associated with the Canadian tar sands in getting the oil out of the sand show up in Canada's carbon emissions and not ours. So those are two things that would, if we had an accounting system that was based on consumption rather than the production side, we would see a somewhat different world, and China's carbon emissions would not be nearly as large as they are, and other countries that, such as the U.S., would be higher than they are. But even given that, the trend of the last 4 years and the trend that we see for the next several years are based on a constant in terms of our relationship with China and with Canada.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.